This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Our top story today, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has announced his resignation as leader of the governing Liberal Party and therefore as Prime Minister. He will remain in post until a new Liberal leader is selected from the party. But with a general election due sometime before October the 20th, has he left it too late for his successor to have any chance of winning that? Mr. Trudeau has been in office for nearly a decade, but has come under increasing pressure to go, not just from opposition parties, but from within his own. Last month, his finance minister quit over policy differences, and more than 20 other party members have publicly urged him to step down. Speaking outside his official residence in Ottawa a few hours ago, Mr. Trudeau announced the temporary suspension of Parliament, and he said he was putting the needs of the country first.
My friends, as you all know, I'm a fighter. Every bone in my body has always told me to fight because I care deeply about Canadians, I care deeply about this country, and I will always be motivated by what is in the best interest of Canadians.
But he went on to say it was time to make way for a new leader.
I intend to resign as party leader, as Prime Minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process. Last night, I asked the president of the Liberal Party to begin that process. This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election.
Well, when Mr. Trudeau took office in 2015 as a freshly elected and some might say fresh-faced new Prime Minister, he said he was confident populism had no future. He told the BBC at the time that he thought the rise of the so-called anti-politician, like Donald Trump, for example, had been overstated.
You have, over the past little while, seen the rise of the anti-politician, whether it was our own Rob Ford in Toronto, who was very much an anti-politician, or Donald Trump, who makes a big thing about not being a politician. I think that has, to a certain extent, run its course, just because people don't want the usual kinds of politicians, fine, but they're also looking for people who are actually going to be serious about bringing people together and serving and being upfront about the tough decisions we have to make.
While in office, Mr. Trudeau relished every opportunity to portray his socially liberal values and even seemed proud of his label as a woke leader. But he did have to confess to previous missteps, which certainly wouldn't be considered woke, including having to apologise after photos emerged of him wearing blackface.
In 2001, when I was a teacher out in Vancouver, I attended an end-of-year gala where the theme was Arabian Nights, and I dressed up in an Aladdin costume and put makeup on. I shouldn't have done that. I should have known better, but I didn't, and I'm really sorry.
Mr. Trudeau, is that the only time in your life you've ever done something like that?
When I was in high school, I dressed up at a talent show and sang Deo. With makeup on.
So what do Mr. Trudeau's allies make of his decision today? Catherine McKenna is a former Liberal MP and was minister in his government for 6 years, mainly dealing with the environment and climate change. I asked her whether she thought Justin Trudeau had made the right decision today to step down.
This was definitely the right decision to make. To be honest, I called for the Prime Minister to step down about 6 months ago, not because I didn't think he had a legacy to be proud of, but it was quite clear that Canadians don't think he's the best choice. The polling has been very bad, but I think people are just, they're tired of the Prime Minister and the challenges that we stand to lose all the progress we've made, whether it's on climate change, something I care greatly about. We've reduced child poverty by half. We managed to get through very difficult trade negotiations with the U.S. and they're looming again. And our economy is in a good space. So I think it's not that Canada isn't better off after a decade of his leadership. It's just that we need a real choice because there's going to be an election by October latest, likely sooner. And I don't want us to lose all the progress we've made. And with the prime minister, Justin Trudeau, as the choice, it was clear that Canadians were going to vote against him as opposed to voting for something.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned the polls, and they are actually abysmal, aren't they, for the Liberal Party. The Conservatives are ahead by, well, at least 25%. The New Democratic Party is less than one percentage point behind the Liberals. Has Mr. Trudeau actually left the party hanging, left it too late for any replacement leader to claw back any sort of credibility ahead of those elections, which have to happen before October?
Look, I think there is a possibility. Elections are about choices. So as I said, without Justin Trudeau being the choice, do you want him or not? And there's a real choice between a progressive party that's actually working really hard to improve people's lives and a very different conservative party than we've seen before. We used to have a progressive conservative party under Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, who cared about climate change, who didn't fall into polarization. That I do think that there is a choice. People will get a chance to choose someone new.
From what you're saying, it's all Mr. Trudeau's personal fault that the Liberals are trailing so badly. Does the party not bear any responsibility at all? I mean, they supported all his policies all this time.
Well, I think I'm saying something different. I'm saying that in an election, you have a choice. And with Justin Trudeau, we know he's just not that popular with Canadians. I mean, that if you walk down the street, you will hear that. Part of that is being in power for 10 years through COVID and with inflation and rising interest rates and the cost of housing. Part of it is just people are tired of him. So my point is really, if we want to have any shot of keeping progressive policies, then we need new leadership. Of course, after 10 years, there are going to be things that people didn't like. And I think housing prices is a real issue. The cost of housing is really high. I think there may have been some missteps on immigration where we got, you know, that it's good to be open, but, you know, you also have to have Canadians' confidence on your side. But I think overall, there's a record to be proud of, and Canada is better off. But it's going to be challenging, 100% for sure.
So who do you think should replace him as leader of the Liberal Party, and who would stand the best chance in the election?
Well, I'm a competitive swimmer, so I like races. I don't think we should anoint someone. I think people are going to have to actually go out there and explain what they would do. In particular, like, we're going into very hard times in Canada. We have Donald Trump has said he's going to impose 25% tariffs immediately, and 80% of our trade is with the United States. So this is actually, you know, really, really important who eventually becomes prime minister. There are lots of good people. You know, in the UK, you would know the name Mark Carney. He was the governor of the Bank of England. He has indicated that he's interested in running. We have our former finance minister who just stepped down, Chrystia Freeland. She's indicated she's interested in running, and there'll be others. And so I think what people need to hear is, why are you running and what would you do? And in particular, how would you manage the relationship with the United States? Canadians want someone that will build the relationship with the United States, but stand up for Canada's interests.
You talked very charitably about Mr. Trudeau's legacy, the positive things he's achieved. You also mentioned some of his failings, but is there a danger that his greatest failing will go down as leaving it too late to resign?
I certainly hope not. I mean, that would be extremely unfortunate. We have seen in many cases it is hard for leaders to leave. I think now there's an opportunity, but the party is going to have to work very quickly to have a leadership, and then we'll see. I'm going to be working very hard to support, you know, this leadership and a new leader, and then there'll be an election and we will see. But it is consequential for Canada.
That's Catherine McKenna, former Liberal MP and Environment Minister under Justin Trudeau. So what next? Let's take a quick look at the process and how long it might take to get a new Liberal leader and Prime Minister. Stephanie Levitz is a senior reporter at the Canadian publication The Globe and Mail.
The party has a set of rules that it ostensibly needs to follow in order to choose a new leader, and that puts the timeline sort of anywhere between 6 weeks to 4 months, depending on how you interpret those rules. Of course, those rules, as I just mentioned, are open to interpretation. And right now, the party's executive, has been parsing through their constitution, trying to figure out what to do. I think we expect some clarity on that in the coming days. But ultimately, that March 24th deadline, it may in fact be the deadline by which the Liberals are going to have to choose a new leader. Because, you know, after the end of prorogation, we have here what's known as a speech from the throne. Those are considered confidence votes for us. The opposition parties here have all said they will vote to bring down the government at the earliest opportunity. That would be the earliest opportunity.
And so is there a clear front runner at this point? And how do you rate the Liberal Party's chances in the upcoming election? What should their strategy be now?
So there is no clear front runner, and that's part of the reason I think that it took Mr. Trudeau so long to arrive at this decision, because had there been a clear front runner, say in the same way that there was with Kamala Harris in the United States taking over from Joe Biden, it's more likely that Mr. Trudeau would have been gone many months ago, but there was no one was coalescing around a particular person in order to push him out. The polls suggest right now that the Liberal Party was going to be, destroyed in the next election by the opposition Conservatives. They were poised to romp over to a majority government. Some public polling has suggested with a new leader at the helm, the Liberals might regain some semblance of a presence in the House of Commons. But by no means do the public polls suggest today that the Liberals could hold on to government even with a new leader.
Yeah, you mentioned the Conservatives are way ahead in the polls, aren't they? But what about the left? Because the New Democrats are also sort of chomping at the heels of the Liberals as well.
This is one of the interesting things that, for the Liberal Party, one of the criticisms levied at them by some within is that they've gone too far to the progressive left over the last several years. And in so doing, they have cannibalized a lot of the vote from the New Democratic Party, which is why they haven't really seen any meaningful bump in the polls in quite some time. Should the Liberals go ahead and pick, let's say, a more centrist leader, what we refer to in our political discourse as a blue liberal, someone who's slightly more fiscally conservative, but perhaps socially progressive, that could open up some votes for the New Democrats, and they could in fact see their fortunes improve come the next election. But that might very well depend on who the Liberals select.
And just very briefly, of course, Mr. Trudeau has suspended Parliament just as a new Trump administration is coming in, which is talking about relations with Canada. What might that mean?
What at least means, I suppose, for Mr. Trudeau, and depending on the rules they set, is that his core cabinet ministers who are in charge of the Canada-US file perhaps can set some of this internal party dynamic aside and try and set Canada on some kind of course to respond to Mr. Trump. But, he's very much a lame duck leader at this point, and it's unclear how much room he actually will have to respond.
Journalist Stephanie Levitz there from The Globe and Mail. And there's more on this story on the BBC Live page if you want all the details on the parties and the race to be the next leader. Coming up later, it's January the 6th, the year after a presidential election, so it must be results certification day in the US, but it's also a date now burned into the national consciousness, and we'll be hearing from one of the police officers on duty that day in 2021.
I remember coming around the corner of the Upper West Terrace and just being horrified to see hundreds of people streaming into the building. Just an unimaginable thing for us as officers, as Americans, and I think most people around the world to think that a crowd of Americans would be so violent to break into the United States Capitol, our sacred sort of temple of democracy.
More on that interview to come. And our main headlines, as we've been hearing, Justin Trudeau has announced that he's stepping down as the Prime Minister of Canada after 9 years in office. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. In the war in Gaza, there appears to have been the tiniest bit of movement towards a ceasefire deal. On Sunday, the BBC was shown a list of 34 hostages whom Hamas suggested they're willing to give up in return for a ceasefire and a release of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. But Israel says that Hamas hasn't yet clarified who on that list is still alive. Well, one of the names there is 84-year-old Oded Lifshitz. He was abducted along with his wife, Yocheved. She was released after 16 days, but Oded remains in captivity after 458 days. Their daughter, Sharon, came into the NewsHour studio a little earlier today and spoke to my colleague, Tim Franks.
I think I always try to dampen my enthusiasm because the chances of my father are slim. He was frail 458 days ago. I also thought my mom did not survive, and then she just emerged from the ground. So I hold hope.
Your father, he's 84 now, is that right? Have you had any news since your mother was released after 16 days of captivity as to the status of your father?
My father was injured on the 7th of October in his hand and in his legs. My mom thought he was dead, but when the hostages came back in the first deal in late November 23, it came true that he was alive, that he was with another woman from my kibbutz in the same room, that he was seen on the first day by another hostage that returned. So we know he was alive to begin with. We know he looked for my mom. We know he was not in a good condition, and we know his condition was deteriorating.
In terms of what needs to happen now, I mean, clearly you would say, look, a deal needs to be done right now to release all the hostages and for there to be a ceasefire in Gaza. Given you've been making this argument for so long, what pressure do you think you can put on the Israeli Prime Minister to take the final steps?
The vast majority of the Israeli public is behind the idea of finishing the war against what is often being people assume here. And we are trying to do all we can to push on the incoming Trump administration. I believe that that is our biggest leverage. I know that the Qataris are back in the negotiating table. It feels that there is a real push for it. And hopefully there will be enough in it for the Prime Minister of Israel to finally, and far too late for many people who lost their life as a result, to say, yes, we will withdraw from Gaza, we will go for a final deal.
You say a majority in Israel obviously want the release of the hostages, but there will be a large number of people in Israel who will say Hamas is still a threat and it can't be trusted. It will play with the emotions of Israelis for as long as they possibly can, as far as the hostages are concerned.
History shows us that you can't absolutely eliminate an organization that is fanatic, ideological. For Israel to stay there in order to keep fighting this fraction and this fraction of Hamas actually undermines the achievement in this war. I don't agree with this war. I think we should have gone to exchange of hostages at the very beginning. My father would have been home. Many people we have buried over the last year would have been home. Our loss is so devastating. We know some of the hostages are dead. We are really needing to get them back. Hamas is a bigger problem, like Al-Qaeda is. Israel has alliances in the Middle East. We have Egypt. We have the PA. These are forces that should come in and start running Gaza. It seems that Hamas agreed to that. The people of the Middle East, the people of the region, the people who believe in the sanctity of life, we want a ceasefire. And absolutely, Hamas should be eliminated, but it cannot be eliminated by war.
Sharon Lifshitz there speaking to Tim Franks. Next to a good news story, how Portugal and Spain have worked together to save the Iberian lynx. The medium-sized wild cat was on the brink of extinction with a population down to just 94 in 2003. But since then, a coordinated programme for breeding in captivity has boosted that number now to over 2,000 in the wild. And in 2024, its status was lowered to just vulnerable. Antonio Fernandez reports now from southern Portugal.
Navarro, a male lynx, calls a female during mating season. His chances of success are now not that bad.
The Iberian lynx was very, very close to extinction. We're talking about just 25 females in reproductive age across two populations that didn't interact. We only had four animals in captivity back then. The only feline species that was threatened at this level was the saber-toothed tiger thousands of years ago.
That's Rodrigo Serra, who coordinates the program for reproduction in captivity across the peninsula. The 1950s saw changes in the use of land for agriculture and brought with it efforts to protect cattle from predators. People were even paid to hunt them, he says. Then, from the 1980s, two pandemics led to a fall of 95% in the numbers of wild rabbits, which are key in the species' food chain. The Portuguese center, down in the Algarve, is fairly remote, and as the animals hide away in their pens, it feels incredibly quiet. We are whispering because even though we are some 200 meters away, our presence is stressing the animals. Rodrigo says sometimes that's exactly what they need.
When we notice a litter is becoming a bit more confident or getting closer to the keeper when he's in the central corridor, we go in and chase them and make noise so they are scared again and climb the fences. We're training them not to get close to people in the wild. That's why there's a complete absence of human contact. Food is always done through a tunnel system, out of which the live prey comes out. So they never associate food with people. A lynx should be a lynx, not be treated like a house cat.
Lynxes are moved across the reproduction centers depending on the needs. And when the time comes, genetics too determine where they are released to diminish chances of inbreeding or disease. Alcoutín, on the border with Spain, is one of the places where lynxes are released. Pedro Sarmento, who has studied them for 30 years, waits by a main road, the kind that kills lynxes often.
Unlike most felines, the lynx has a short tail, has brushes in the ears and a long beard. As a biologist, there are two things that strike me when I'm handling a lynx. It's an animal with a fairly small head for its body and extraordinarily wide paws. That gives them an impulsion and ability to jump, which are rare.
These sounds of a mum calling her cubs have been captured by the camera traps set to track lynxes and their behavior. Looking through the footage, we can see some were here just this morning. The team says there's three main reasons why the conservation program has worked: international collaboration, improvement of numbers of prey, and raising awareness with the population. Now there's hope that by 2035, the species will reach a favourable conservation status.
Antonio Fernandez there, reporting from southern Portugal on how the Iberian lynx has been saved.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives, and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Xing Xing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Jack and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad, or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of Season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It's awards season in Hollywood, and the Golden Globes kicked off all the glamour last night in Los Angeles. There are 27 categories across film and TV. Among the winners, Demi Moore and Adrian Brody. But our LA correspondent Emma Vardy has all the details because she was there.
Known as Hollywood's biggest party, there was no shortage of A-listers out to dazzle on the red carpet as awards season got underway. Baby Reindeer, the British drama about stalking and sexual abuse, picked up two awards in the television category. Its creator, Richard Gadd, called for more of life's darker tales to make it onto screen.
Any story, when done right, is universal, and all the weird idiosyncratic struggles we go through on a daily basis are just as worthy of being committed to screen as any.
Shogun. But it was the Japanese drama Shogun that won the most TV awards of the night. One of the big winners of the film categories was the unusual musical about a Mexican drug lord in transition.
Are you English?
No, I'm not English. Why?
No, because you you are pretty.
Emilia Perez, winning four prizes. The film's transgender star, Carla Sofia Gascon, accepted the award for Best Musical or Comedy.
You can maybe put us in jail. You can beat us up, but you never can take away our soul, our existence, our identity.
You, come with me.
Of course.
Not you. You.
Audiences have been flocking to Wicked after its popularity as a stage show, but it only won one of its nominated categories for box office achievement. Something has changed within me. The Brutalist won the top drama prize as well as Best Director and the Best Actor award for Adrian Brody.
I hope that this work stands to lift you up a bit and to give you a voice. And I'm so grateful. I will cherish this moment forever. Thank you.
And one of the biggest cheers of the night was for Demi Moore.
Demi Moore! Yo.
Who, after 45 years in the industry, won her first ever major award with Best Actress in a Musical or Comedy for her role in The Substance, a satirical horror about aging and Hollywood's beauty standards.
Today, I celebrate this as a marker of my wholeness and of the love that is driving me, and for the gift of doing something I love and being reminded that I do belong. Thank you so much.
Hollywood's big hitters, including Angelina Jolie, Nicole Kidman and Kate Winslet, were vying for Best Actress in a Musical Comedy, but the top prize went to Brazilian star Fernanda Torres for the film I'm Still Here.
This is a film that helps us to think how to survive in tough times like this.
A night of some surprises provided plenty to celebrate and debate at the after parties.
Thank you. Good night.
Emma Vardy with all the news from the Golden Globes there in Los Angeles. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Herbert Kickl, the leader of the far-right Freedom Party in Austria, has been asked by the president to try to form a government. The country has been in a state of political chaos since elections in September left no party with a workable majority. The Freedom Party, or FPO as it's known, did win the most votes with around 29%, but other parties refused to work with Mr. Kickl in coalition. So in October, President Alexander Van der Bellen asked the Conservative People's Party, which came second with 26%, to form a centrist coalition. That collapsed at the weekend, leaving pro-Russian Eurosceptic Herbert Kickl back in a leading political role. Well, President Van der Bellen said that it had not been an easy decision to make, and anti-Kickl protesters gathered outside the presidential palace to oppose the move.
Persecution of marginalised groups, mass deportations, cuts to social benefits, a return of a fascist state. We say we have learned something from our history, but then at the same time we elect a chancellor like Kickl and let him take power. We have learned nothing from the past.
So why is Mr. Kickl considered such a divisive figure? Our correspondent in Vienna is Bethany Bell.
Mr. Kickl is abrasive. He has a very pugnacious style. He has insulted the president of Austria, who's 80 years old, calling him the mummy that lives in the presidential palace. His views on immigration, as we heard there, on many other gender issues, have upset his opponents. He's also has been able to bring his party to the best result they've ever had, coming first in the September general elections. He said he wants to be a Volkskanzler, a people's chancellor. And that's a term that the Nazis used for Adolf Hitler, though other politicians have used it too. And he has upset many people across Austria's political spectrum, so much so that we had the situation where, until very recently, all parties in Austria said that they wouldn't do an alliance with him, with Mr. Kickl as the leader of the Freedom Party. Mm. But then when attempts to do it failed to have something else, the Conservatives have now changed their mind.
Yeah, so just tell us why that attempt at a Conservative-led centrist coalition failed.
Well, it was a slightly unusual situation to ask the second party that came second in the general election to try and form a coalition. That was the Conservatives. They got 26%. They were trying to do a deal with the Social Democrats and a third party, the Liberal Neos, which was a small party. It was quite unwieldy. They had major differences about issues like tax cuts, the budget, and eventually the Liberals pulled out. And then a day later, the Conservatives pulls out, saying that they couldn't form a two-party coalition, which would only have had a majority of one vote. So now the ball is in the court of Mr. Kickl. We understand, will invite the Conservatives to coalition talks, and they will have Austria's waiting to see whether they can form a coalition.
Our correspondent in Vienna, Bethany Bell, there. And as Bethany was explaining, attempts to build a centrist coalition led by the Conservatives fell apart this weekend. Chancellor Karl Nehammer of the People's Party quit the leadership when he couldn't reach an agreement with the Social Democrats. So will the new party, under new leadership, decide it will work now with the far-right Freedom Party and Herbert Kickl himself, who Mr. Nehammer has said is a security risk? Well, I've been speaking to Reinhold Lopatka, who's a member of the European Parliament, an MEP for the Conservative People's Party. It now has an interim leader, Christian Stocker. So does Mr. Lopatka think his party should do a deal with Mr. Kickl?
Kickl was not our first choice, but now we are in a situation that we have to form a government. And it was Austria's federal president who asked today the leader of far-right party, the Freedom Party, to form a government, and we are ready to start negotiations. So we have to do what we can to form in the next weeks a new government in Austria.
He said it was a difficult decision, though, to ask Mr. Kickl to have a go at making a coalition. And members of your own party, including Mr. Nehammer, have said that Mr. Kickl is a conspiracy theorist. He's a security risk, which would be worrying, wouldn't it, for any potential chancellor. How would your party propose to work with him, given that many in your party have described him as being a neo-Nazi?
I would not say he is a neo-Nazi, but you are right. Kickl is a polarizing figure with some Russian-friendly positions. He has also anti-European program like Orban in Hungary. That was the reason why no party at the beginning was willing to work with Kickl. But the negotiations failed because the far-left party leader of the Social Democrats was absolutely against the reform agenda, which is needed, and he was only in favor of new taxes. So what to do? The Freedom Party, they won, and we have to respect the result. You are right. We criticized Kickl a lot, and he has to change.
Okay, so how is your party going to do that? How is it going to be able to hold Mr. Kickl and his party to account? Because from what we see in the polls, the Freedom Party is doing very well. It suggests they're even more popular now than they were in September when they got the most votes. Aren't you worried that if your party facilitates a Kickl government, he'll then be in a position to call a snap election and potentially win that outright?
No, we have to be optimistic. We will have to start serious, but tough negotiations with the Freedom Party. It is the third time we form a government with the Freedom Party. And the two former ones, they were pro-European governments, and we could fulfill our promises.
You've said that it's effectively your party's duty, really, to try and make a coalition work. But as you say, it is a far-right party. Mr. Kickl is a divisive figure. Members of his party have been accused of performing Nazi salutes, singing SS songs. Are these the sort of people you want to be allied with in politics?
No, of course, not at all. We know our history. We know that we have to do a lot in Austria to fight anti-Semitism. And we did a lot. The Jewish community here, they are worried. I can understand them. On the other hand, I have to say it is our duty to do it for the state, to avoid a government crisis here in Austria. This is a difficult situation, of course, but I think it is the right decision to start these negotiations. We will see if we have success. No party will dominate the next government. But of course, it will be the first time that a far right-wing party will have the chancellor. This is absolutely new in Austria.
And worrying for people like you.
It is a big challenge. But what is the alternative? To have new elections. And after new elections, we would be nearly in the same situation. Maybe in a situation which makes it more difficult. Because the Freedom Party, if we have elections now, would not lose. So what?
And that was Reinhold Lopatka there, who's an MEP for Austria's Conservative People's Party. Some parliamentary news from the UK now, because MPs from all the main parties have supported a proposal to transfer all frozen Russian state assets worth billions of dollars to the Ukrainian government. The idea is not just to support Ukraine, but to punish Russian aggression. The vote was passed about an hour ago in the House of Commons, but that's just the beginning of the process. Shortly after that vote, I spoke to the British MP who proposed the motion. Mike Martin is an MP with the Liberal Democrat Party. He's also a former army officer, and he told me why he thought the UK should lead other allied nations to send frozen Russian assets directly to Ukraine.
Well, we've got to this stage in European affairs where there is a clear moral, strategic and legal imperative to do this. These assets were frozen at the beginning of the war, and we're already using the interest from them to fund Ukraine. But when you have a state like Russia that's committing war crimes, genocide, torture, mutilation, that's not something that we can stand by. And then, of course, there's the strategic concept, which ultimately in the UK, we consider that Ukraine is fighting for us. And if Ukraine were to fall, we would then be defending our allies, our NATO allies like Lithuania, Estonia and Latvia. So the moment has come, particularly with the election of Donald Trump, who is very hot and cold on Ukraine, certainly doesn't feel the same way about European security as previous American administrations. Now is the time to take those assets and to send them to Ukraine for their defence and actually for our defence.
So in October, the UK government did announce it would be providing Ukraine with a $2.2 billion loan as part of a broader package from the G7 nations, didn't it? This would be different to this. But what are the potential obstacles, including legal obstacles, to this actually being, this money actually being released to the Ukrainian government?
The sort of opposition to this falls into two camps. And, you know, as you said, the motion has passed. And so now the UK government is going to investigate how we can do this legally. But the problems fall into two camps, either ones of financial stability. So, and $300 billion is obviously a lot of money. If those are seized, what implications does that have for financial markets? And the other one is a sort of legal argument. And that is actually a much weaker one than the financial stability one. There is a clear doctrine in international law of state countermeasures, where if a state has committed grievous violations of international law, like genocide, like all the other war crimes Russia's committed, then states are authorised to take countermeasures against them. And ultimately, one way of looking at this is that seizing these assets now is a down payment on the future reparations that Russia's going to have to pay anyway.
Are you confident this will be processed through and actually happen?
Well, look, I think what's really important here is unity. So this debate, I sort of did the legwork in pulling everyone together, but ultimately this was a cross-party debate. So all the parties, all the main parties in the United Kingdom Parliament supported the motion, and the government did not seek to block it. The main opposition didn't seek to block it. So in matters of this, you know, we've been unified on Ukraine in the UK and in the House of Commons, and we seek to maintain that unity. But if you are seeking to change policy and you want to keep unity, you have to move slowly, slowly. So I am quite certain that the government is indeed going to investigate this. And then the next step is then calling on them to actually do it.
And that was Mike Martin, MP for the minority opposition Liberal Democrat Party here in the UK. He brought the motion debated in Parliament today. He's also on the Defence Select Committee here at the UK Parliament.
It's great to have you with us here on the BBC World Service. At 23 GMT, Hard Talk is joined by the comedian Frank Skinner.
The act begins with me. I have no powers of invention at all, really. It's just autobiographical. So any change in me is then reflected in the act rather than the other way around.
That's followed by The Conversation. This week, they hear from two women using their chronic pain to fuel their creativity.
People don't understand what it's like to have chronic illness and experience chronic pain, and that's massively important to be able to get that idea out there.
And then we join Max Pearson for the History Hour.
20 years on, the Boxing Day tsunami, Klaus Fuchs, who gave nuclear secrets to the Soviets, and the real-life Ripley of Ripley's Believe It or Not fame.
Now, let's rejoin Rebecca Kesby and NewsHour.
And a reminder of our top story this hour. Justin Trudeau has announced he's stepping down as the Prime Minister of Canada after 9 years in office. Former Environment Minister and Trudeau ally Catherine McKenna told us it was the right move to make with an election looming later this year.
This was definitely the right decision to make. To be honest, I called for the Prime Minister to step down about 6 months ago, not because I didn't think he had a legacy to be proud of, but it was quite clear that Canadians don't think he's the best choice. The polling has been very bad.
Other headlines, the US Congress has met to certify Donald Trump's election victory. More on that in a moment. And European leaders have accused the US-based billionaire Elon Musk of using his social media platform X to interfere in the continent's politics. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Heavy snowfall and icy temperatures in Washington, D.C. have not hindered U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris officially certifying the results of November's presidential election. She effectively read out her own defeat.
The votes for President of the United States are as follows. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 312 votes. Kamala B. Harris... Kamala D. Harris of the state of California has received 226 votes.
Well, this is a traditional and usually barely even a newsworthy formality, paving the way for the peaceful transferal of power, in this case the inauguration of Donald Trump later this month. But on this day 4 years ago, it was a very different story. A violent mob of Trump supporters attacked the Capitol building.
Oh,
They broke into the halls and chambers looking for then-Vice President Mike Pence, demanding that he overturn the election result, and some even threatened to kill him. Winston Pinjon was on duty that day as a police officer at the Capitol. So what had they been expecting to happen?
I was working overtime. I'd come in early with my riot squad and had my gear on standby. We were told that a group could be coming to the Capitol and that we should be prepared for potential violence. But really, we were sort of left to think that this would just be another day, just another protest.
So at what point did it become clear that this was totally out of the ordinary and a violent insurrection is how most people look at the events of that day?
I remember first hearing calls for help on the radio by my fellow officers. And as we responded over to the West Front, marching in, seeing two individuals, one after the other, that had had medical incidences, who both ended up dying that day, and then seeing gas deployed and just seeing how many thousands of people converged on the Capitol so quickly and became so violent towards me and my fellow officers. It's hard to pinpoint one specific moment, but I remember coming around the corner of the Upper West Terrace and just being horrified to see hundreds of people streaming into the building, just an unimaginable thing for us as officers, as Americans, and I think most people around the world, to think that a crowd of Americans would be so violent to break into the United States Capitol, our sacred sort of temple of democracy.
It sounds really frightening. And you were one of those who was assaulted by a mob of people, weren't you? Do you want to tell us what happened?
So shortly after I came around the corner and saw the people entering the building, I went through to try and push the way through the crowd. And I got up to one of the doors that they were entering to try to prevent them from further going in. And in that time is when I was punched in the face and struck, knocked on my back, and felt like they were on top of me, trying to stab me with flagpoles, pepper spraying me. They ripped my baton from me. And I remember thinking, I just need to protect my gun because I don't want them to take my gun, but thinking, this is it. I might die right here on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, because we were just so outnumbered. At that point, I'd been separated from my riot squad. It was just me and a couple other officers and hundreds of them.
There's been a lot of criticism for the way it was handled on the day, the slow deployment of the National Guard to assist you police officers that were there. Do you have views on what happened on that day and what should have happened?
You know, at my level of just being boots on the ground, a lot of what happened above, I wasn't privy to, and I don't know. I mean, I've read a lot since then, but in hindsight, of course, there perhaps should have been better preparations and precautions taken. But at the end of the day, it's sort of victim blaming because we showed up to do our job. You know, if the former president hadn't incited that mob and hadn't sent them to the Capitol to attack us and break into Congress, then it wouldn't have happened. So my take is the officers who showed up that day, particularly those from DC police that came to assist us at the Capitol, are the real heroes, especially those who have continued to show up day in, day out. And it's important to acknowledge those officers because it is not an easy job.
Well, around 170 police officers were hospitalized as a result of what happened on that day. I think it's about four officers that took their own lives in the months after this incident. And you yourself gave up your job, didn't you, within about 10 months of this. Was it because of what happened on January the 6th?
It wasn't only, but it certainly did play a role in my departure.
What was it about that day that did have that impact on you?
It wasn't even just that day. It was then what happened after and what has continued to happen after, where the events of it became so downplayed and whitewashed, and there were so many just blatantly false lies, ridiculous conspiracy theories. And it just seemed like our country was so polarized, and we still are today. But some of that just utter disrespect that we're seeing now, with the potential to pardon these violent felons, convicted criminals who violently assaulted me and my fellow officers, who could very likely soon be pardoned. The message that that sends to our country and to the world is really shocking, just really devastating, and it is a tragedy.
Yes, President-elect Donald Trump has promised to pardon the January the 6th rioters, hasn't he? Has all of this changed how you feel about politics, even?
It has made me I've just been so disappointed. It's very difficult to not be cynical and to not feel incredibly depressed and concerned for the future of average Americans, all of us, and for our democracy and the future of our country ahead. I think one thing I learned through my service to the Capitol Police is how important and fragile our democracy is. And so I'm trying to be as optimistic as I can be and say this is the will of the voters, of the majority of American people. And so I really just hope for the best. I hope that what they get is what they wanted.
Don't you have to take an oath as a police officer?
Yes. As a federal officer, I take the same oath that any federal servant, to include the president, to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And I'm very proud to have done that. And I really hope that the future president will do the same, but we'll see.
Former police officer Winston Pangeon there on duty at the US Capitol building on the 6th of January 2021. That's it for this edition. The news is next.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohammed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.